Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am Anna Fishson, your host, and today it's my great pleasure to be speaking with Donald Moss about his recent book, At War with the Obvious, Disruptive Thinking in Psychoanalysis, published by Routledge in 2018. So first, I will briefly introduce him. Dr. Moss is a psychoanalyst in practice, private practice in New York City for more than 40 years. He's the author of four books, including the one, of course, we'll be discussing today, as well as Hating in the First Person Plural, 2003, 13 Ways of Looking at a Man, Psychoanalysis and Masculinity from 2012, I and You from 2017, as well as more than 50 articles. He's the recipient of the 2017 IPA Elizabeth Young Brule Award for his work on prejudice. He's the incoming chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association Program Committee. Fun. Sounds good. And a founding member of the Green Gang, a four-person collective focusing on relations between human and non-human environments. Also, on a personal note, he is my colleague, mentor, and inspiration. Don, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Anna.
So, first things first, the book is a collection of essays, and I am interested in what ties them together. The title is, of course, suggestive, and you make some of your main arguments and explicit in the intro and first chapter. One point of departure and leitmotif is a seeming impasse. A paradoxical question: How do we as analysts maintain an opening, you know, for thought, for flux, for uncertainty? In other words, do we resist? How do we resist unreflexive doxa or common sense, as you call it, and yet draw limits, create frames, norms that make possible theory, you know, interpretation and meaning? So maybe you can develop this for our listeners and also say something about how you came up with the title.
Well, let me start with the title. The title is a product of theft. At War with the Obvious was the title of a photography show at the Metropolitan by a photographer, a favorite photographer of mine, William Eggleston, who's a Southern American photographer, and his images are of basically banal, common, often suburban scenes in Mississippi. And what he's able to do with these images, I think, is to suggest in ways that are methodologically out of my reach, that behind the banal images lies profound and important determinants which cannot be articulated by way of the image, but just the suggestion of deeper determinants, I think, is what he might be meaning by at war with the obvious. That is to say, it's at war with the obvious's claim to be entire. So I think that, of course, is the working premise of almost all of psychoanalysis, that the presentation, no matter how thorough, inevitably is the product of warded off determinants. So really, at war with the obvious means something kind of obvious, which is the struggle to resist the claims of the surface to be entire. And the surface always does claim to be entire. So I don't know. It was my way of paying homage to Eggleston, as well as suggesting that psychoanalysis, since its inception, has been at war with the obvious. Basically, the entire theorization of the unconscious is a way of saying that unconscious determinants are at war with or struggling with the obviousness of consciousness.
Yeah, no, related to this is the first chapter, chapter one, Against Common Sense, you draw an opposition between sincerity and theory, which was interesting to me because it's, I mean, can you explain this a little bit? Like, I think both are mapped in relation to truth, and you defend theory, it seems to me. So maybe you can say something about that as it relates to, I mean, what's wrong with sincerity, you know?
Well, there's nothing wrong with sincerity. There's nothing wrong with practically anything that names itself honestly. And I think sincerity does name itself honestly. But what's wrong, if there's something wrong with sincerity, is its claim to be entire. That is, the moment one says, I am sincerely grateful, I am sincerely, if the thank you is followed by, no, I mean it, I'm sincerely grateful, it's the implicit, spontaneous denial of something else. The word sincere is like a thumb in the dike. It sort of disavows. It's an additional force that the obvious employs to buttress its claim to be entire. And it seems to me what theory does is, and what makes it in, look, I don't mean to say theory is immune to the same problem, because we can say, do the same thing. Well, that's what you say, but theoretically, it can't be the case. It has the same function then too. It's a way of using a notion, theory, to actually dismantle something in a brutal way rather than in a thoughtful way. So both sincerity and theory can be used brutally, let's say. And it's the brutal use of either one that I would say I'm at war with.
Yeah, I think it's, I hear it more common, it's more common for people to say that theory has this power to obliterate, whereas sincerity, you know, affect or spontaneity is more linked to truth. And that's the sort of more common move, I would say. But yeah, I see what you're saying, that both can be used.
The idea that affect can be trusted seems to me so problematic. I've never really understood how that notion has entered psychoanalysis in any kind of welcomed way. Why would we trust affect? It would be like trusting party clothes to tell us the truth about the guests. And I think party clothes, well, of course, there may be some partial truth, but there it's intended to dress up.
I can't. I agree. I do. So, but let's move. I wanted to ask you about the third chapter, which I liked a lot, The Insane Look of the Bewildered Half-Broken Animal. That's what it's called. You talk about how we take refuge in the first person plural, we, you know, in order to stabilize the I, the many ways that we engage in this kind of identificatory mapping, and how violence ensues when our maps are redrawn or something new appears on the scene. So I'm wondering what served as the inspiration for this chapter. And you provide a very vivid clinical example too in the chapter, and I was wondering if the clinical example sort of came first and then the chapter was built around it, or the opposite.
The title of the chapter comes from the Kafka story, A Report to the Academy. And this is a story that has always ranked very high for me in literature. So I think that the story was the inspiration. And the idea of this ape who is trained to speak has always struck me as a kind of parable for human development. That is, in some way, we are all apes trained to speak, and all of us, like the ape in the story, kind of melancholically barely remember our native land from which we have been extracted. So I wanted to start with that, and I wanted to somehow present the narrator of the essay as essentially another ape who is looking around at the contemporary world and seeing so many like-minded apes who are, I don't know, simultaneously being drowned at sea and clamoring at the gates. And I think that so it also invokes refugees, and I think I mean to suggest that people in psychoanalysis are, in their way, refugees. That is, they're pounding at the gates to be permitted entrance into, metaphorically, the first world. And people in analysis feel themselves to be more or less limited. It's kind of unfairly limited, and they want access, and they don't know how to get it. And in one way or another, they're all pounding at our gates with this insane look on their faces. So I don't know, that's sort of the general drift of things. And that one clinical example where the man almost beats me up and calls me a faggot, and then I, a few hours later, have the epithet faggot ringing in my ears, and feel myself wanting to employ it against a gay man I see on the subway platform. It seemed to me it's a very good example, I think, of the kind of infectious power of first-person plural hatreds and how they provide us with short-term antidote against both desire and all the weakness that goes with desire and humiliation and being the in helplessness. So I think part of first person plural moves is to purchase a kind of strength that first person singularity can never possess.
I wanted to ask you about sexual aberrations and this chapter about where you basically talk about sexuality as a fetish, and you discuss the three essays. It reminded me of my recent interview with Alenka Zupancic, who's about her book, What is Sex? And where she argues, and she's not the only one who argues this, that sex is the fundamental antagonism or fissure in being, and that it gets covered over with sexuality or normative sexuality. And so I'm wondering if you're making a similar point. And also, you know, is finally sexual aberrations, is this a useful, like, what is the final pronouncement what is the pronouncement in 2018? Because I think I heard you present about this like 4 years ago or something. And then you still thought there was a usefulness, there was of some use. Have you changed your mind?
No, I haven't changed my mind. I think that, And here's how I mean that. I think that we all might recognize that violently forceful, power-driven sex. We all, whatever we might say about that, we oppose it, and would we want it to be cast in the zone of the aberrant. So to me, I think that it would be foolish and reckless to throw out the category aberration per se. And instead of that, I would prefer to preserve the category and examine its contents and to be alert to the very real likelihood that we have overpopulated the category with what were once felt to be aberrations, and we systematically have removed various aberrant, practices or from the category. But I don't think the category itself warrants removal, because we need some kind of word to refer to sexual practices which we find abhorrent or incompatible with whatever our notion of the social contract and civilization might be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So what would be, but what do we make of this idea that more and more practices that were once considered sexually aberrant are now considered, quote, normal? I mean, doesn't it give us pause, you know, to label certain practices, whatever, aberrant, terrible, et cetera, when we understand that there's a contingency? I mean, is that okay? I mean, where are the lines drawn? Where are the categories? Who gets to decide? You know, this is the.
Well, of course. Yeah, exactly. But this is true. It seems to me this is true. This kind of problem is not just a problem of sexuality. I mean, who gets to decide is a very broad question pertinent to almost all categorizations. Who gets to decide what is theft? You know, who gets to decide what are the rights of private property? Well, of course, you know, when you push the question, you're going to come down to capitalism, and you're going to come down to who gets to decide how capitalist society will be organized and what kinds of behaviors will be permissible and what kinds will be deemed unlawful and aberrant. So I think in that sense, I don't think that the sexual aberrations are in a formal way different from other aberrations, let's say, or transgressions as they are, what's the word for it, you know, categorized across the structures of civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, if according to the Foucauldian, you know, sort of paradigm, that it's the sexual aberrations that govern, you know, norms, that they're different from juridical categories and, you know, criminal categories of crime categories. They're self-regulatory mechanisms too. So,
well, I don't know. I think that's an uphill battle to demonstrate the truth of that. It doesn't seem to me that the notion of a self-regulating category at all seems to me anti-psychoanalytic. Why would a self regulate a category? For what?
Well, the idea that there are power relations, that people are caught in regimes of power, and it's sort of, yeah, right.
That's right. Well, so we're saying the same thing. So the self is not doing the regulating.
No. But yes, the self is an object in this case, right? I phrased it a little bit incorrectly. Yeah.
Right, but it seems to me that as analysts, we're our work is directly at the interface between self and object, or self and society, in which we interrogate the power relations. And that's the same thing as the refugee thing. What are the power relations that are taking place at the encounter between analyst and analysand? And it seems to me, if we really were able to precisely delineate those power relations, they would replicate the power relations that take place in one's body, having to do with sexuality, and also take place in the shopping mall, having to do with what one can permissibly lift up and touch and take. Boundary relations, and how are boundaries determined? Because it seems to me the sexual aberrations, whatever they might be, emanate from issues of how are boundaries determined, and once a boundary is determined, what kinds of regulated passage is permitted to take place across boundaries. And the aberration, at least in my view, would only appear when a boundary is being violated. And what constitutes a violation? Well, what I mean to say is that I think we need the term violation. I think if we need boundaries, which I think we do, you can't have a boundary without an idea of violation. They're
right. We need something. We need some kind of coordinates, you're saying, because we can't build a theory. We can't interrogate without some kind of delimit.
Yeah. I think we can't live.
We can't live. Let alone
theory. I mean, we can't proceed without some notion of boundaries between us and et cetera. Yeah.
I mean, it also speaks to this kind of, the criticism of psychoanalysis or this, some people feel that it's it regulates and it's normative, and others, of course, you included, would say that that's the furthest thing from the truth, that it opens and interrogates and constantly throws into question its own categories. I mean, that leads into the three essays again, because that's very much what goes on in the three essays, where Freud kind of carves out new conceptual spaces, but then he's not really, it's almost like he's not fully ready to accept them. So then he's uncomfortably sort of retreating from them, even as he's putting them forward, right?
I think that's true. I think that's true of all of us. Even now, I think I think that's how we know we're approaching a boundary of any kind. That is, we become aware of our own discomfort. That's how boundaries make themselves known, I think. And we are tempted to come as close as we can to the boundaries, overstep, retreat. And I think that's what Freud does. Now, the boundaries that he's contending with are different than the ones that we're contending with. But that same spirit of pushing past a boundary and seeing what happens, and then retreating and pushing past and retreating, I think this kind of thing came up in JAPA a couple of issues ago with this Hansberry paper about, what is he called, the transgender edge. And it's a boundary paper that provoked a number of responses. Hansberry kind of aggressively crosses a boundary, and then the responses are about the meaning of his crossing.
Is this what you call in another chapter erotic thought? You speak about jump thoughts, and yeah, maybe you can say something about what that is and why it's erotic. or maybe we're not talking about that now, but it seems to me we're kind of touching on this.
Just to go back to your what we were speaking of when we started about the obvious, it seems to me that whatever the obvious is, and whatever consciousness is, particularly in clinical work, it aims to be confident of itself. And I think that thought that is confident of itself never needs a second thinker. So I think that what I meant by jump thoughts or erotic thought occurs when the second thinker introduces himself or herself in a way that surprises the first thinker and reminds the first thinker of the pleasures and possibilities of being in relation to a second thinker. It's a sort of interruption of a self-enclosed reverie or a self-enclosed of self-enclosure. It doesn't have to be a reverie. And it interrupts this self-enclosure, but not in a brutal way or in a an attacking way, but rather in a surprising and opening way. And in that sense, the surprise and the openness I think of as warranting the name erotic.
So then why, I recall you saying something about neutrality being erotic. How does that work? Or does it? Or is that something else entirely?
Well, I think that neutrality can be, if our starting point as humans is desiring, neutrality is essentially emerges from a baseline starting point. It's a kind of hum, an erotic hum that is alert to all the possibilities for it to erotize. I think neutrality looks to connect. It's a kind of evenly hovering attention, I think, means attentive to the possibilities of connection. And in that way, it's neutrally looking everywhere for, it's like a kind of promiscuous attention, looking everywhere for possibilities. And you know, in that sense, kind of, I don't know if I want to say promiscuous, but polymorphously attentive. It refuses nothing. At least in principle, it refuses nothing, open to everything. And in that way, neutrality becomes erotic.
Okay. Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, so moving on to chapter six, we're still on sexuality, I think, but maybe a little taking a different turn. So you talk about creativity. I was a bit surprised by this move, actually, and I wondered again how, like, did something piss you off because to write about the fetishization of creativity and contrast it with work, you know, like, is it creativity being this kind of almost impediment or a fetish object that kind of is shiny and alluring, but really kind of potentially empty. It made me think about this new word that has come up, this neologism that I hear, you know, in the consulting room, which is like creatives, like as a noun, or a collective identity, which the younger people use, which I recoil from. I'm trying to kind of not have this reaction because it's just too much. But I really, I thought about it the way that, you know, there are creatives out there now. And anyway, that's my own problem, but with it. But what is, is this a provocation? I mean, did you intend this as a provocation, or is this something that you feel like analysts should be wary of? You know, and why?
I do think we should be wary of it. I think, you know, I write fiction myself, and I write a lot, and I care a lot about writing, and know a bunch of people who write, and some who play music, and I never do I get the sense that the person doing the writing or the playing is trying to be creative. It seems to me what they're trying to do is be honest. They're trying to give representation to something. They're trying to represent in some kind of rigorous way something. And in a way, it's almost against creativity. That is, the product comes by way of it being true to its true to what is instigating it. And in that sense, creativity would represent a kind of other than honest production. And I think that we don't say of a very honest person, Abraham Lincoln, he was so creative. We say he was so honest. I mean, I don't know if he was, but, you know, just as a figure. Right, we don't say that. We say he's honest. And in fact, were we to say of Abraham Lincoln, he was being creative, in a certain way, we would be questioning his honesty. We would be saying, well, we don't want Abraham Lincoln to be creative. We want him to be honest. And so there's some, I believe that the word it screws people up because it becomes the creatives, or I want to be creative, or I want to be a creative person. And I think what that almost always leads to is a feeling of alienation. That is, in order to be creative, I have to be other than what I am. That's where my creativity will be. It will reside in that's not me. and it was intended as a provocation. I don't like the kind of another thing that I think it does, the word creative, is that it if not fetishizes, it hierarchicalizes. You know, I think we all have the possibility of being honest, whatever I mean by honest, I'm not sure, but more or less, we can be honest. And I think that when we put creativity as a esteemed value, we can easily be diminishing the value of honesty. And of the two, I definitely prefer honesty to so-called creativity.
It connects to the other chapter about applied psychoanalysis. I feel like, you know, you seem to be suspicious of that as well. Do you have is any of it, do you feel that any of it is good? I mean, there's something fetishistic there too in this, because it's not what, because transference doesn't function there somehow, or it's not alive. because the object of applied psychoanalysis is dead. I mean, it's...
Well, I think that for me, applied psychoanalysis... Look, I guess if I have a problem with applied psychoanalysis, it goes back to what you were saying about theory. It seems to me most of the time, applied psychoanalysis represents the triumph of theory over its object. And I don't celebrate that victory. I don't think it's necessarily psychoanalysis at its best when our theory is able to master its object. What's her name? I forgot. One of Virginia Woolf's sisters or wife of a brother or something like that said something about science pinning its or interpretation pinning its object down like a butterfly, like a butterfly would be pinned in a science experiment. And it's this pinning down and devitalizing that I think is problematic about applied psychoanalysis, which I don't think applies to all applied psychoanalysis. I think that if the interpretive effort in implied psychoanalysis actually ends up opening a space that had previously not been opened, then I think applied psychoanalysis functions like a jump thought or functions erotically. But I think most of the time what happens is that it closes off further inquiry by triumphantly mastering its object. So I don't know, there too, I guess I'm intentionally being provocative. You know, for instance, with my use of the Kafka story, is that applied psychoanalysis? I don't know. I don't know if it is. But in a way it is. It takes a cultural artifact and applies psychoanalysis to it. But I don't think it applies psychoanalysis in a where analysis masters the story and then moves
right. The
on.
Story elucidates a psychoanalytic concept rather than kind of you're not psychoanalyzing the object there. You're using the story to elucidate something about within the theory, no, or to advance a kind of theorizing.
Yes, I think the story and psychoanalysis elucidate each other, because I think the story also opens up more possibilities for psychoanalysis, and I think maybe a certain analytic look at the story opens up more possibilities for the story. So I think it's a win-win. For both sides.
So we're coming up against it. So I wanted to talk about two other chapters that I really loved. One was the one about the Abu Ghraib photos. I think it's called On Thinking and Being Able to Think, Reflections on Viewing the Abu Ghraib. So there you talk about what happens when you look at a work of art or documentary photos in this case, or and really any object or performance, and when suddenly there's a collapse of the frame, and specifically when the gaze appears within the framed spectacle and your look is registered in the framed spectacle, you're obliterated as a subject, but because you lose that privileged perspective. And so like you basically, you're discussing, you know, how an object can look back at you, as it were, you know, make you into an object, and then you suffer a collapse of symbolic space. I think you say legibility. Yeah. And so this is the uncanny, it's the anxiety producing moment. But then this is the move you make that I want you to talk about. So Then you make this other dialectical turn. You talk about the creation of a new frame after such a collapse. Like, what is it that enables the reestablishment of the frame, of the capacity to think? So what is it? I mean, what is that about? Like that, I mean, so there's this collapse. Yeah, you sort of see you have this uncanny experience, and then you're able to regroup. How do you do that?
Well, I think you can only do that if the experience has not been traumatic. I think if the experience is really traumatic, you can't do it. So I think in a certain way, the kinds of experiences that I'm talking about, viewing the photos or viewing Maria Abramovich, or I think I mentioned in that paper, I think I mentioned the little boy in the phone booth. Is that also included in there? Yeah. There's a video of this boy who's a drunken boy who can't get out of the phone booth. These kinds of situations, they render you helpless and, you know, well, helpless, but it's only temporary, and essentially whatever capacities you have as a person are not really damaged. They're just interrupted. It's a sort of profound confusion rather than a trauma. And I think in that way, it's not a big deal to be able to reconstitute. I think that's how we distinguish extremely difficult events from traumatic events. I mean, if the event is extremely difficult and challenging and we lose our bearings, well, okay. But then if moments later or even a day later, we have restored our bearings and can look back at the event with some kind of confidence, then we know that the event has not been traumatic. Not for us. And then we have this new problem. What does it mean that we're able to escape the trauma that we've just been witness to? So there's a boundary question too. You know, what position are we occupying that we have safely escaped while the object of our gaze has not? And then we have a new problem. But also a new awareness that we've escaped, that we didn't even know we were escaping until we've escaped.
Yeah, you were using the word we, and I was reminded of actually one of the things that, you know, you talk about finding one's place among the viewers again, locating oneself within a collective, basically, which is helpful in reestablishing the social link in order to reframe again. Yeah. Okay, so, and then I'm rushing now. But chapter 11 is I and you, which is, do you want to talk about that? Or yeah, why don't you just tell the listeners about it? You wrote down one line from every session for 1 year, from every session, right?
Yes, and so it's a book also. So this chapter is just excerpts from the book. Yes, I wrote down one sentence from every session for a year, and then each day collated the sentences in the order. So the first sentence came with the first session of the day, the second, the third. And I really love this project. I didn't love it so much initially, I wasn't sure, but once it got going, I thought that these days' collations ended up being, in my view, extremely beautiful. They were kind of evocations of a sort of baseline, melancholic, human humming, like, you know, a kind of, I don't know, almost like mortality underneath it all. And this cluster of sentences, how many sentences, 8 times 150 is like, you know, 1,500 sentences or something. just all of them expressing a sort of yearning, a sort of sad yearning, not each particular sentence, but the whole group of them. I just found it beautiful, I don't know, it's like Studs Terkel, but only sentence by sentence, and no particular person emerges. And I really like the absence of any particular person. It's just anonymous sentences spoken by people in a condition of desire and sadness. I don't know, it just seemed to me to really work. I think it's my favorite project. It's my favorite project because one of the things about it is that it's impossible to name an author. It's a book, but I didn't exactly author it, nor did anyone else. It just kind of emerges like it was a very complex found object. So I don't know, that's all. But you were going to say something.
Well, I was questioning this idea about, you know, anonymity, actually, and whether, because it's titled I and You, and I thought, what is this I there doing there? It's in the title, but it's elided maybe in the text. And I thought maybe it's you, it's Don Moss. Do you hear yourself? Because you did choose, you chose, and that's a very important part. I mean, and of this obviously, and but it's yours, but your subjectivity. I mean, maybe that's the one. That's that humming sound, or that's the sort of glue, or the basso continuo, or something that undergirds all of this. Or maybe you hear yourself. I mean, do you hear yourself when you read the? Is this intersubjective? Do you hear the patients? Do you recall the individuals?
Yeah, kind of vaguely. And I mean, if pressed, I could, but I tend not to. And I know the sentences when I've read them in public to other analysts. Many analysts say, "Oh, my patients don't use sentences like that," and you know, I don't know what that means. I'm not making these sentences up. But sure, the choices were mine. And I meant the I to be not me, but so many of the sentences have the word I in them. So I meant that I to refer to the speakers more than to me, and the you to refer to me. I mean, I could have entitled it I and You by Me.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more awkward, yeah.
Yes.
All right. I actually think we've run out of time, unfortunately. Don, it's been so much fun talking to you and having you on the podcast again.
Okay, it's been fun for me too.
I was just going to remind the audience that I've been speaking to Dr. Donald Moss about his new book, At War with the Obvious. Thanks again, Don.
Okay, thank you, Anna.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Till next time.